Okay. There's so much lag in starting the stream in OBS, and when it finally shows up on
Yeah.
YouTube, it's crazy. It's because they improved the system.
Wow.
Yeah.
OBS or YouTube?
YouTube.
Ah, I
You
see.
used to take like 2 seconds between the time you started the stream on OBS before it started playing on YouTube. Now it's like 10, 15 seconds. It's crazy,
Wow.
maybe longer. Way to go, YouTube.
Interesting.
You're making things awesome for everybody. Hey, everybody, it's Real Monsters. I'm SK Barrett. Joining me is the ever popular Wes Hobrick.
Hello, hello, hello. Man, do we have a case for you tonight?
Don't we? And it's not even a flu case.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, it is an interesting one and also sets us up for next week, which we'll get into
Yeah,
towards the end of this.
kind of does. It's fascinating how it's connected to
It
what we'll
really
do next
is.
week, which we haven't mentioned yet, so the audience doesn't know what the hell we're talking about.
No, actually, I edited the Killdozer post to reflect that
Okay.
on the page. Yep.
Yeah, next week is Killdozer, which is a pretty awesome story in itself for the most part. I mean,
Who built the
it's
tank?
awful, but it's tragic in so many ways, but yeah, you'll find out. If you don't know about Killdozer, tune in next week and you
Yeah.
will.
16 years ago today is the anniversary.
Any other news?
Man, they finally brought in the four other officers who were involved in the death of George Floyd.
Three other.
Set, oh, oh yeah, three other.
Four total.
Set bail at $1 million per head, which is really a little low if they only have to produce 10% of that. But
Right.
yeah, I mean, we'll see with that whole situation. The thing that I most worry about with that, honestly, is if they do anything short of throw the book at these guys, you're
More
going to see
riots.
the rioting. Yeah, even more rioting. So that's just
Well,
very.
and which, it's complicating things because, yes, you want justice, but if you want justice, you can't politicize it. But it's too
Right.
late. It's fully politicized, and
Oh,
in
yeah.
an objective sense of the word, it'd be impossible for these guys to get a fair trial.
Right. I totally agree. I don't
I'm
think
not
you would
saying
find a
they're not
venue.
guilty. I'm just saying nobody can go into this on a
Totally
jury and be
unbiased.
completely unbiased.
I don't think you could find a venue in this country
No.
that would fit that bill.
No.
Yeah. With national media and social media too, once you get down to it. But yeah, I mean, you have
Again,
all that
I'm not
and
saying those guys are innocent, that they should get off or anything along those lines. I'm just saying, from a objective justice point of view, they got no chance.
politics needs to be separate from that.
Too
Right.
late.
I mean, I'm not saying that they shouldn't be, thoroughly punished for what they did
Absolutely.
either. But yeah, I mean, you have to keep those things separate if you want to preserve the good things about our system, like due process of law, like a speedy trial, like
Well,
habeas corpus.
and then once people realize they can raise hell and get a criminal verdict to go the way they want, guess what they're gonna do?
Yeah, they're gonna keep doing
They're
it.
gonna keep doing it.
Right. Oh, absolutely. But I mean, there's no question that what happened to George Floyd was unequivocally monstrous. But violence and politicizing the good things about our system is not the answer to fixing it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Honestly, I think the answer to, well, first stopping the violence right now is de-escalating with peaceful protesters, if you're law enforcement, showing that you understand that their concerns are valid, you know, like some public display of that. And at the same time, focusing your department's resources and energy on the people who are getting violent.
Absolutely.
You see, yeah, you see so many of these reports of people who were not violent but got maced, or the black guy who was in, man, I can't remember where the protest was, but he was just driving. He wasn't even a part of it. An officer shot rubber bullets at his vehicle. So, you know, they need to be careful about how they're using these tactics.
Absolutely true. And frankly, if I was, and I mentioned this to you privately, I think if I was in charge of organizing one of these peaceful protests, I would mm-hmm. totally set up the rioters by, you know, showing up, waiting for the troublemakers to arrive, and then disappear and say, tell the cops, go get them.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, use military tactics against them. You know, that would a classic feint maneuver. You draw in the enemy, and then you get a flanking maneuver on them with the cops, and boom, you just get out of the way and let the cops have them.
Yeah, and using military tactics does not equal federal troops.
No. I'm talking about tactics.
Right. I'm just making that distinction because some people don't seem to understand that I've been talking to off of this. But, yeah, I mean, I have been helping to organize a protest here, a peaceful one, and I can say that I can't see anybody who has tried to infiltrate it for those nefarious purposes. But we're a small town, too, you know, 40,000 people where I live.
There's a small town north of here called Snohomish. It's a cute little town, you know, with a, you know, an older, very small downtown area that's old buildings that have been revitalized, shops, mostly rural in the area, a lot of farms and ranches. Mm-hmm. The Antifa motherfuckers thought they could go there and cause havoc.
Oh, Lord.
So the downtown area filled up, not with rioters, but with locals with guns.
Well,
they reported that these kids would get out of their cars and look around and go, nope, and get in and leave. I don't know what the hell they thought was going to happen, but it wasn't that.
Play stupid games, win stupid prizes, kids. Yeah. Oh, man. In non-police protest news, there was a guy who was caught in the town of Richmond, California, which is up in the Bay Area, north of San Francisco. And this guy, no kidding, was caught eating his 90-year-old grandmother in a very public place.
Whoa. I mean, how public of a place?
If my understanding, it was just off her porch.
Oh.
So probably in the yard close to the sidewalk. But
do they know if he killed her?
That's a good question. They have not released that part of it yet. But
is cannibalism illegal in California? It's not in a lot of places.
I would think that they would construe it as abuse of a corpse in the very
quite possible.
In the very most base way that you can think about that, the most reductive
right
way. But yeah, apparently this guy they caught, it, people saw him over her body trying to eat her. And when police approached, they tried to get him off and it didn't work. So they tased him. And he's been undergoing a extensive psychiatric battery and I would imagine a toxicological battery.
Gotcha.
At the hospital where they took him. So I'm thinking drug insanity for this one.
Sounds like that bath salts behavior that we saw in Florida several years ago.
Yeah, that could be a possibility. Or do you know a drug that a lot of people don't think about much anymore, but is popular in especially poorer areas? In fact, the poor areas of Washington, D.C. had a problem with this. It's PCP.
Yeah.
I mean, it can make you hallucinate and do those sorts of things, but yeah, I mean,
don't do drugs.
McBarrett, the crime dog, says don't do drugs.
That's right.
But yeah, that's really all that we have to talk about. I mean, you can look on the website, on our Facebook page, that is facebook.com/realmonsters, for the rest of the news. We keep a national beat, sometimes a world beat of crime news there. Oh, I'm sorry, Real Monsters Podcast. facebook.com/realmonsterspodcast. That is really all I have besides.
All right. Well, we've got plenty of weird in this one case. Let's get into it, shall we?
Oh, absolutely. This case is so interesting because it, of its novelty, you don't often see quote unquote normal people crack the way David McGreevy, the Monster of Worcester, did. And as a side note, before we get thoroughly into this, that spelling and that pronunciation always messes me up.
Worcester?
Worcester, Worcester. But yeah, man, British English for you. Yeah, that always messes me up with that. But this guy, he didn't have any history of violence about it. And as far as we know, no history of mental illness either. But we have some theories on that that we will get into. Now, these murders that occurred on April the 13th, Friday, 1973, are also variously called the Friday the 13th murders.
Ah.
Which, interestingly, Friday the 13th was not a thing together until the novel of the same name in 1907. Friday was considered an unlucky day because that's the day that Christ died on. And 13 was considered an unlucky number because Judas Iscariot was the 13th apostle. And also and
being 13 was his whole problem.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything else.
But yeah, I mean, it really wasn't a thing together, though, until 1907, was the way that I was understanding it when I looked deeper into this. Although the Knights Templar were killed on a Friday the 13th in 1307, which it just sort of is a another thing that people like to retroactively lend to that day.
Right. That was made popular, well, made widely popular by the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah. Don't believe Dan Brown's bullshit, people. Yeah.
It's fiction!
Yeah, exactly. don't read into it as history. Although he was actually sued for libel by the authors of a different book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
I thought it was going to be by the Templars, but I guess that wouldn't be the case, would it?
Yeah, no. But, yeah, they sued him and they lost. But, yeah, getting into McGreevy's life, he was born in Southport, England, 1951, to Bella and Thomas McGreevy. He's the second of six kids. No typical signs of violence or really much of anything going on. His dad was a sergeant in the Royal Signals in the British military. So David moved around a lot. You know, the life of a military child on really any continent, I would assume.
Pretty much.
But he had a pretty normal childhood. He's educated in army schools. And as far as I could tell, there really wasn't much of a record of discipline there. Although I would ask whether it was more regimented and that sort of thing, maybe a little bit more punitive than, say, your typical civilian school. But I don't know. His mother said that Germany was their family's happiest time. The kids would often go skiing, hiking, picnicking, and they really did everything together. Now, this is when we get to the first thing that could be construed as to a predictor of Mr. McGreevy's future mental state. When he was in his teens, he stole his mom's shopping money and went from their family home in Cardiff, Wales, to Liverpool, which is about a four-hour trip. He basically ran away. But, you know, some criminologists who look at this...
He ran away. He stole money from his mom and ran away, and that's supposed to be like some, oh, my God, moment?
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I thought, too. The one criminologist who studied this, a guy by the name of Professor David Wilson, put a lot of emphasis on that. Although, to me, yeah, that could be very much just typical teenage rebellion, too. Not necessarily something indicative of a psychiatric problem.
Yeah, I am really unimpressed with that as being some warning shot.
Yeah, and it might be the case where when you hear what this guy did, people look back in hindsight and try to fit it in as well, you know.
Oh my God, he watched Saturday morning cartoons. He's a monster.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But, yeah, at 15, he left school and enlisted in the Royal Navy, which had been a lifelong dream for him. Because of, you know, what his dad did, I would assume.
Right.
But by the late 60s, he was stationed at Portsmouth Naval Base. And he joined his first ship, the HMS Eagle.
Got
which
a picture.
We actually have. Yeah,
coming right
pictures
up.
Of both of them. And that was, like I said, his lifelong ambition. But his dad kind of dogged him and really doubted his dedication for something like that, which is the first bit of what I would say is real evidence about what my theory is regarding this guy, which we'll get to.
Okay. So everything goes great on the carrier, right?
Well, his colleagues there called David arrogant and cocky, was their term.
Ooh.
But
that's,
you know, maybe that's related to his age,
right? That's also, you know, the pilots are supposed to have that, not other people.
Yeah, this is true. He did have quite the long disciplinary record from his time in the Navy. And there was one notable infraction on it, which occurred at the RMAS Broadie in Pembrokeshire. And they, at that place, David was a steward in the mess hall. And he had seen his name written in a chief petty officer's book, which he thought was going to be indicative of him getting a new job.
Okay.
Which I would assume, based upon what happened next, he didn't want. When he turned up for his watch the next day,
So he thought he was going to be reassigned to this job that he didn't want, just to be clear?
Yeah.
That's what's going on. He saw this writing, thought, oh shit, I'm going to get this job and I don't want it.
Yeah. Yeah, or I don't want to leave the one that I have.
Right.
But yeah, when he turned up for his watch the next day after seeing that, he is toasted and very agitated, was how they described it. You're drunk off his ass, basically. And what he ends up doing is breaking into an officer's wardrobe and setting fire to a bin with papers in it.
Is this on the ship or on the shore? Do you know?
I believe that is on the shore.
Okay.
The RMAS Pembrokeshire. And David claimed that he accidentally dropped a cigarette, which caused it. But yeah, even if that's true, you're still in there drunk.
Yeah, drunk on duty and starting a fire. The Navy really is kind of cranky when it comes to fire.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, because here's the thing. Fire is about the worst thing that can happen on a ship.
Oh, yeah, I haven't thought about it that way. Because it's so contained already.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And on top of it, too, with all of this in this incident, he raised the alarm at 2:30 a.m. right after it happened. So this is in the middle of the night.
Oh, Jesus. So on top of everything else, he wakes up everybody.
Yeah.
Pisses everybody off.
Yeah. He expected them to think, still after all this, that it was an accident. But he is court-martialed. He's found not guilty of arson, but he is found guilty of negligence. So I guess they kind of believe him there.
By the way, just so everybody knows, court-martial is not an outcome. Court-martial is the procedure. It means a military court. That's what court-martial means. It means you go to court.
Yep.
It's not an outcome.
Precisely. The outcome of it was he got 90 days in the brig, basically. And when he's in there, he's given a extensive psychiatric battery.
Sure.
But... his CO, his commanding officer, never revealed the results. And his parents were given no explanation for his behavior. And you got to remember how young he still is, too. Technically still a minor. Throughout all that. And that psychiatric report is still going to be pretty relevant after we get into the actual crime here. Because as far as I could tell, the British military is still sitting on
it. Really?
Yeah.
What, national security bullshit for some 19-year-old?
Not wanting to have egg on their face with a guy who brutally murdered 3 children? Could be.
Hmm. Yeah.
Which makes me believe they saw something in it as well. But
hey, here's the thing. If you don't want to get egg on your face for knowing about some asshole being an asshole, let it be known. Then it's not your fault.
Keep it secret.
Jesus, this is not complicated.
Oh, absolutely. It's sunlight is really the best disinfectant with these sorts of things. But you know, there's no doubt with this one that the fire was impulsive behavior. You know, that is pretty unequivocal. While it might be a little bit more equivocal, like we were talking about with him running away. Let's see. Yeah,
still,
go ahead.
Still a young man away from home for the first time in his life, not counting running away.
yeah.
Getting drunk and misbehaving and not really hurting anybody. So far, it's not much of a case.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's going to get way out there when we keep going through this. But in 1971, McGreevy is shore based at Portsmouth Dockyard after a tour of the Far East on the HMS Eagle. And a friend of his suggests that he should write to the friend's sister. And from January to April, McGreevy and the sister, Mary, exchanged about three letters a week. And these letters are long. They are, you could call them purple prose.
Okay.
In a lot of ways. Very Baroque. Could be another term for them. each of them was about six pages in length, too. So,
Man, remember writing letters?
Oh, man.
That was a lot of work.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. He only really met her through the correspondence. He had never really met her in person. But in April of 1971, he does meet Mary for the very first time. And 1 week after that, at a party in Birmingham, he proposes to her. Which I think you could argue is more impulsivity.
Yeah, that's a whole subject.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, once you consider he's only known her for what, 4 or 5 months?
Do we have a picture of her?
I couldn't find one of her.
Just making sure that none of these pictures are her. Yeah. So we see, you know, I have known this to be a thing with some people from time to time, guys proposing to females on first dates, even.
Oh, wow.
Now it's social media, you know, just right off the bat. But this tends to be an emotional, you know, being emotionally undeveloped.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would very much agree with that.
Yeah, thing where they're, you know, they don't understand, you know, they just like, I need somebody, you, marry me.
Which is a feature of what I think McGreevy might have.
Yeah.
And what might have been in that psychiatric report, which we will get to. But so he sees Mary for two long weekends in June and July of 1971. And again, he keeps up the three letters a week, 5 to 6 pages in length after. But Bella, his mother, did not like her. Mary was in constant pain because of a spinal issue. And I wasn't able to find out what the exact issue was. But without treatment of that, she would ultimately be paralyzed.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But Bella thought that she was a bit of a hypochondriac when you get down to things.
Well, but I mean, it can look that back pain's so nebulous, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it definitely is. And maybe it was, you know, just a psychosomatic thing with her. But by August of 1971, McGreevy's Navy career is over. He's just dismissed. And again, they won't release the records as to why. Could have been they just didn't like his behavior. Could have been the fire thing was just enough for him. But he ends up turning up at his parents' home in Worcester and drops his bags and just, you know, defeated, saying, "I'm out." And he basically, from there, lives in their house, doesn't do any chores, doesn't contribute to the rent, and he floats from job to job.
So a millennial.
How that?
Oh, come on, millennials. It's funny. Come on. I don't mean you personally. I mean others.
Oh, absolutely. I was going to suggest a bit of depression might have been setting in with that, which can occur comorbid with what he might have, my theory of what he might have, which I guess we could just tell it now. Yeah. Borderline personality disorder is my theory here. And we'll get to a bit more of the evidence for that.
All right.
But yeah, I mean, he floats from job to job. And with a lot of these, he's thrown out of the job. He's canned because he's drunk a lot of the time.
Well,
so this is the guy with an alcohol problem.
Really tough to keep a job with if you show up drunk.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And
because how often, you know, does not showing up go hand in hand with being drunk a lot? You show up drunk or you don't show up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're gonna have a hard time. And why would you think an employer would keep you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of people like that. Although I've also known quite a few functioning, high-functioning even, alcoholics.
Yeah.
Being in the business that we're in, the booze business, yeah, I've met a lot of them. But
I imagine.
Yeah. They're the minority, I'm sure. But David's plan was to wed Mary in Christmas of 1971 with this big, lavish church wedding, which I had no idea how he thinks he's going to do that when he doesn't have any money.
It's not like his family's got money either.
No, they really don't. And he, you know, obviously couldn't give her that, which she would have settled for just a ceremony at a local government office, you know, at a local registrar.
Right.
But he was dead set on giving her that big church wedding. So
does the grandiosity, is that a symptom?
It can be. It doesn't usually crop up, but it can be in relation to BPD.
It can be in bipolar.
That's true as well. Absolutely.
So maybe because he definitely had half of that at least.
Oh, yeah. Definitely had, I think, the depression there. And even still, bipolar can occur. Comorbid with BPD too.
Sure.
But he was just obsessed with that. But by New Year's Eve, and actually on New Year's Eve, she broke it off with him. So you have a
New Year's Eve?
Yeah.
On New Year's Eve.
Well, you know,
I mean, it could have been a fight, okay? But if it was planned out, God, wait till the second.
Well, you know, I would bet dollars to donuts he was likely loaded.
Yes,
that night.
I know.
Maybe that was a exacerbating factor.
It's very likely he was being an asshole and drunk and all that kind of shit, and they had a fight and it blew up, and it just happened to be New Year's Eve, and he was already drunk before they even went to the party.
Oh, yeah. And absolutely. But that also gets into another central feature of borderline personality.
Which is?
And that's abandonment.
Oh,
big time
really?
abandonment issues. So far we have, as far as I can tell, two of them, and soon to be a third, because he's not contributing, as I said, around the parents' house.
Yeah.
So they throw him out.
Well, you know, being a, you know, military brat could give a child abandonment issues because daddy's always showing up and then disappearing for long stretches.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that too. Absolutely. And then them, you know, sending him out to the streets to live.
Yeah.
But then you have the his perception of the Navy as abandoning him, too, when they just dismissed him after all that.
Right. And all of his employers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those two. And then Mary was just the final nail in that coffin, as it were. Excuse the metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, just looking for where I was there. She said that the main reason that she broke it off was that she didn't reciprocate the feelings that he had for her, and that she shouldn't have accepted the proposal.
Ah.
And that's another thing. These very high passion and very high passion very early on relationships are another big marker for borderline personality.
Really?
Yeah.
So how old is he now at this age?
1971, he is 20.
Okay.
When we're getting into that. But
and really his first girlfriend.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And
most
so,
definitely.
So he's looking for, he doesn't even know what he's looking for. He just wants, he wants to feel loved.
Yeah.
By somebody.
He's floating around looking for his place in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this all increases the stress in his life as well, which that the stress is actually the main trigger in borderline personality for another symptom, dissociation.
And explain what dissociation is for people.
Dissociation, I'm looking for the right words to explain that. It is essentially not being in control of yourself and not remembering. Amnesia is a big form of dissociation.
Yeah, isn't it kind of like, you know, you feel like, a lot of times it's described as feeling like outside of your body, like you're an observer
possession.
Of your own life.
Yep. Possession is often used to describe it with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in theory, that would take away responsibility for what's happening with it. And a lot of the times it can also occur in the form of a blackout, where you just, you black out, you lose all sense of time.
Right.
And you wake up. And I've had that happen to me when I actually had a reaction to Ativan when it was given to me for the first time.
Yeah, I accidentally had a blackout episode with mixing a Sonata sleeping pill with a little bit of alcohol and then not going to sleep.
It freaked
me the fuck out, man, the next day.
Man.
Nothing bad happened. I actually, you know, I didn't even leave. I did. That's how I realized what had happened is because there were dirty dishes. I had made food during the night that I didn't remember having or making.
Wow.
And it's like, where did these dishes come from? Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
But,
no,
you know,
with mine, when I took it,
it's really scary because you don't know. You know, I could have done anything.
Oh, yeah.
I could have gotten the car and driven away. Who knows?
Yeah, there's records of people doing that. There's record of people having sex with somebody else.
Yeah.
When that happens, it's actually a recognized disorder called sexsomnia.
Oh,
when
man.
When that happens. But,
does that require actually having somebody else?
Oh, man.
Because that would be a real barrier.
Well, yeah, I mean, with mine, I woke up in a hospital bed.
Oh,
didn't
geez.
Know what was happening at all. But, yeah, I mean, the depression on top of it, I would argue, could exacerbate all of this.
Sure.
But in 1972, McGreevy moves in with his school friend, Clive Ralph, at Gillum Street, which we actually have a picture of, in Worcester, where he lives with his wife, Elise, and two kids as of right now. 3-year-old Paul and 20-month-old Dawn. Elsie also, or, yeah, did I say Elise? I meant Elsie. Elsie was pregnant with their third as well. And they were, by all accounts, a happy young family. There was about a 5-year age difference between Clive and Elise. And they described their time there in their childhoods, Clive and Elise, as idyllic, was the word they used. Which Clive, in the more modern age from about 2013 to today, has kept clear of the press as far as I could tell. But Elise still does interviews, and it's just so sad watching them. When you see what has happened to her kids.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Yeah, they Elsie and Clive married in 1968. She was 16 at the time. Clive worked for his dad driving a truck. And David, when he came to the door, basically just asked him, can you put me up for a while I find a place? And he said, sure. You know, this is a community where everybody keeps their doors unlocked and people take care of each other. And the house that they were in was actually pretty tiny too. Only 2 bedrooms. And David shared a room with Paul. And David quite a lot because Clive would be gone on his route with the lorry, with the truck.
Yeah.
David would act as an extra pair of hands around their house. He helped with the kids, watching them, playing with them. He helped around the house, and he even made the occasional meal. So, quite the switch from with his parents. And Elsie, her words were, he just seemed like a normal person. He used to play with the children. And in fact, this is interesting. There was a newspaper account published before McGreevy did what he did that said that he publicly excoriated Elsie for spanking Paul.
Really?
Yeah. So you're seeing just how much of a contradiction this guy is. And during that time, Elsie said he would have the occasional drink, and he didn't really act weird with it. You know, it was normal. And the neighbors actually called McGreevy educated, a know-it-all, and moral. And in Professor Wilson's
sounds
words
like
with all of that, yeah.
Well, the know-it-all word anyway.
Educated as well. Moral, too. Didn't want to skip over that one. But Professor Wilson's called him and summed it up as saying McGreevy was a, quote, normal bloke. And in fact, journalist Tony Bishop, who we have a picture of, too, he's the guy with the really long mustache. Okay. He was one of the first on the scene when the tragedy occurred. He called McGreevy well spoken, was his word. But a drink in him,
yeah,
and he'd be angry and surly. And he would also get a little petulant.
Okay, so I have a alcohol related question for you.
Sure.
Does alcohol change people? Or
does it bring out the real?
Yes.
I'm a believer that it brings out the real more often than not with people. Real grievances on something.
It seems to me from my observations and personal experience that it really is just, it lowers your barriers.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. By definition.
And
you
so
know, that's what it is.
And so you can't, you know, if somebody is really nice when they're sober and really mean when they're drunk, I think they're just mean people that keep it under wraps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's somehow, anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my thoughts with it, is that's what it usually does to people. But local police actually once caught McGreevy very drunk and walking the white line down a main road in Worcester.
Oh.
Yeah. Literally like he's doing the line test for sobriety. And this upset the elder McGreevy, who lived only a few streets away from the Ralphs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This was not far away at all. And Dad, he told him again, stop boozing.
Yeah.
But as we know, he just didn't listen. But Elsie ends up getting a bartending job at the Punch Bowl, which is only 2 miles from their house, which we have a picture of the Punch Bowl, too. She would walk to work, and Clive would often pick her up at closing time. And during this time, David would watch the kids, you know, in that short amount of time that he would do that. Which brings us to the date, Friday, April 13th, 1973. Elsie says her kids were in bed.
Yeah.
Clive leaves late to pick up Elsie, so she's likely waiting outside the bar. They returned. Police were there outside the residence saying, we need to speak with you at the station. And they just told her basically straight up, her children had been murdered.
Oh.
And there was a doctor actually on the scene who had to sedate her because she went hysterical, in her words. And throughout all of this, she was kept on a very heavy regimen of barbiturates to keep that down. And she actually attempted suicide. Like I said, it's just heartbreaking to see.
Well, yeah.
Her
I mean, one of your children, much less all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that short time that Clive went to get her, all three Ralph children had been brutally murdered. David and a friend earlier that day had gone to the local pub called the Vauxhall for cards and darts. And they had apparently had a slight altercation when his buddy put out a cigarette in McGreevy's drink. McGreevy himself had consumed between about 5 and 7 pints. So about 80 to 112 ounces of
alcohol.
How
does anybody drink that much of anything? I don't understand.
You know, I would assume it wasn't a whole lot of time that it was spaced out either.
No. Just the volume of it just baffles me. I can't drink that much of anything.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Especially beer when it, the carbonation always gets to me.
Right.
When I drink beer. But For those who don't know, your liver processes about one drink an hour. And one drink would be a glass of wine, a shot of liquor, or a 12-ounce beer.
Okay.
So that's for most people how that happens.
And why processing? What do you mean by that?
It
metabolizes it.
Yes, it metabolizes it. And you get less drunk after that, basically.
So it takes about an hour for the alcohol to clear, for one drink to clear your system.
Yes. Yes. But Clive ended up going to the Vauxhall to collect McGreevy. And then he dropped him off at the house to watch the kids and went to get his wife. And sometime between 10:15 and 11:15, McGreevy became infuriated with the crying baby, with Dawn. And this is where it's just amazing. Samantha, the middle child, was found with a compound skull fracture. Next, he strangled Paul.
The oldest.
And, yes. And last, he cut the throat of the baby Dawn.
And Louise.
This isn't where it stops, though. After he does all this, he walks down to the cellar, finds a pickaxe, dismembers the bodies, and goes out to a black picket fence in the family's backyard and impales the bodies on it.
The bodies or the heads?
The bodies.
Jeez, without the heads.
I would assume those were there too.
Okay. So what did he use the pickaxe for?
I am honestly not sure.
Okay.
You see a lot of disorganized thinking throughout this, in my opinion.
Okay, so as soon as you started, you know, talking about the axe, I was thinking beheading, right?
Well,
but
I mean,
that isn't necessarily the case here.
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
So
he just displays these bodies in the yard for anybody to see.
Yeah, he doesn't try to bury them. He just displays them for anyone who wants to look by and see it.
That is, you know, we've covered a lot of people who have tried to use an insanity defense unsuccessfully. But that behavior right there is the closest that I've ever heard that might qualify.
I agree. I definitely agree. Although I am not totally sure.
I'm not saying he was insane, but I'm saying that is that behavior of displaying his work rather than hiding it. Mm-hmm. Is the only thing that I've heard out of all these cases that might, you know, get a jury to think, yeah, well, yeah, that's crazy shit.
Approximated at some level, yeah. Yeah, you just do not see that where they're displaying their work so boldly.
In public.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. You see sometimes where they'll make a, you know, they'll pose bodies, but they're still in a hidden place.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. With something like that. All right. There we have a view of the back.
Yeah.
Of it.
That's just, wow. That's nuts. So then, obviously, somebody saw this.
Yes. They saw it and locals saw it and they called the police, who came there and they did not, for good reason, want Elsie and Clive to see that scene.
No. Not necessary.
And they found McGreevy not far away on a road, maybe a couple miles from the house. that same night at about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And he was genuinely surprised when they picked him up. He's like, well, why are you here? What are you doing? And that could be indicative of dissociation.
Right.
That happened at this crime, and alcohol would very much precipitate that. In addition to his other issues, or his other issues that we've been speculating about.
So how much time passed between when the crime took place and he was picked up?
You have about, I'm doing the math in my head, about 6 hours.
Okay, plenty of time to sober up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, enough to get enough sober.
Right.
But another thing that is very interesting about this, that stands out a lot, he used 3 different methods to kill these kids.
Yeah.
That means he had to stop and think between each of them. So there's a degree of premeditation in that.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Very, I mean, typically a killer, you know, who's doing a group murder scenario, they'll just stick to their one, you know, preferred mm-hmm. method for everybody.
Right. Right. Or if it was a drunken rage
right.
that solely caused him to do it, they would just stick to one method.
Right.
And that's what McGreevy told the cops later on in a confession. He said that it started with me just putting my hand over the baby's mouth. And then from there, he found a wire to strangle Paul.
So the memories eventually returned to him?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes.
Did
that happen for you? Because it didn't happen for me.
It did not happen for me either. Maybe I'm wrong in my assessments with him. But, yeah, they said that with this, he gave graphic but measured detail when he gave his confession. I was going to bury Paul, but I couldn't. Okay, well, it does not necessarily follow that you then impale him on a fence. That's a total 360 yeah. on your lot.
Oh, maybe that's what the axe was, pickaxe was for. He was going to dig a grave in the backyard. Well,
yeah. And dismember them so they're easier to fit.
Yeah.
In it. And his last statement with it was, all I can hear is kids.
Yeah, that's kind of the nature of kids.
Oh, man. But
kids are so noisy that when they get quiet, that's when you worry.
There was a couple psychiatrists who speculated that it might have been a sex crime with that.
Any evidence of that?
There's no evidence that he ever molested the children that I could find.
Okay.
Maybe he had the thoughts about it, but there's no evidence with those children. And as far as I could tell, there was no evidence of him ever molesting any other children.
Yeah, that kind of thing doesn't just, you know, spring up on a guy when he's in his 20s, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cultivated sort of thing. But Tony Bishop, the guy who we were talking about, he said that when he got there early to the scene, mm-hmm. after being called by his editor late at night, that the blood was congealed on the fence that he impaled them on.
Wow.
And they quickly got a photographer out there, but they weren't able to really get much in the way of that. And that picture, that total picture of the family,
yeah,
is the only one that survives of it, of really? Them, of the Ralphs.
And the,
although it doesn't have Clive in it.
Right, it doesn't even have the dad.
Come to think of it. Now, witnesses, Robin Harris and his fiance Jane Perry, were at Jane's sister's house nearby. And about 10:30, they said that they heard a dull thud from the residence. And Jane got a little scared with that. And Robin decided that he was going to go investigate, but she begged him to stay there with her because she did not feel safe until her brother-in-law got home. And then both of the men would go investigate it. So that's what ended up happening. They heard when they were when they were by the house, they heard a second dull thud, and they saw the lights on in the house and the cellar. So they likely caught him when he was going down to get the pickaxe, or right after he got it.
Wow.
Based upon that timeline. And another neighbor said that they saw a tall, thin man with shoulder-length hair in the garden, which could fit McGreevy. But others say that they saw nothing around that same time. So this is one where you got a lot of questions.
Absolutely. But,
Professor Wilson made a very interesting point, I thought, with all this. In any household, the most powerful person is a small child, once you get down to it. They're also the most physically weak.
Yeah.
But the house has to set all their demands, all their schedules, and everything around that child to make sure their needs are met.
It's true.
Once you get down to it.
Well, I mean, there's a parallel there to farming. You know, my parents come from farm country, and you know the rule is, you know, the animals come first because they can't take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great parallel there with that. Makes a lot of sense. And when you factor that in with the kids, David was also essentially a powerless person. And what's that going to do? That's going to engender a lot of rage in somebody.
Yep. Interesting. So if he feels powerless, which was, to be honest, largely his own doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's these other little creatures running around that are tiny little, you know, helpless little creatures, these children, and yet they're very powerful in that, according to, you know, that dynamic. And, you know, there could be a lot of resentment there, right?
Yeah. Oh, I definitely think so with that. It's just really a question of what it was that made the moral wall that said it's wrong to kill them come down. You know, and you have the alcohol, of course. But I think things, too.
99.999% of people who get drunk don't murder children.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But if that is pre-existing, it could remove some of the inhibition to not do it. Some of the inhibitory factors.
Something else had to be a factor. Absolutely. That's kind of what I was saying.
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
Not enough. Alcohol is just not enough on its own.
And that's where I think you get into that idea of BPD and everything else. But yeah, after this, he has about 10 different hearings where he is at all of them remanded without bail. And his trial actually happens on June 28, 1973, exactly 13 years before I was born. And it lasted, get this, just 8 minutes.
What?
His trial, yeah. So he ended up just pleading guilty.
Oh, I see. Was that unexpected?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, in a lot of ways it was. But he got a minimum of 20 years. And it was shortly after all of that happened that Elsie tried to commit suicide for the first time.
Yeah, that's awful.
And Clive, he just couldn't cope. And a couple months after, he came to her and asked for a divorce.
It's almost cliche, you know. Families oftentimes do not survive the death of a child.
Yeah.
Under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you said before, murder kills whole families too. Most definitely. But now for the record, McGreevy was constantly attacked in prison because, of course, a child killer is going to be viewed as lowest form of life.
Yeah.
In 2006, though, he's transferred to the Ford Open Air Prison, which I'm not totally sure how one of those works.
Open air prison. Are they camping?
Oh, man.
This wasn't in Phoenix, was it?
No, but he was transferred there, and then he was put into a hostel, which is problematic.
Like a halfway house?
Basically. But the son discovered this, and they actually printed it on their front page, which I think we have a picture of in there. This resulted in Mr. McGreevy getting sent back to Gen Pop in the closed air prison.
Okay.
That's where the son, they photographed him wandering Liverpool. But soon after that.
Is that, I think, that picture there?
Oh, it's the picture of the guy in the black jacket with glasses. That's McGreevy wandering Liverpool. But they send him back to Gen Pop and...
this one?
Oh, it might be a bit of a lag on my end. No, that one is... We're going to get to in just a second.
Okay.
It's relevant to something.
Whatever.
Else.
So they got a picture of him.
Yeah. Shortly after this, he was granted what's called an anonymity. Yeah, that's it. That's the picture. That is David McGreevy. He was granted an anonymity order shortly after this.
Really?
Which is a concept that would never fly in the United States because of the First Amendment.
It's just like basically giving him a new identity and... sealing records or what?
Basically, what it says is in press coverage of anything that happens as far as his trials or his hearings or anything, they cannot use his name, his location, or the details of his crime.
What?
That is an anonymity order.
That's... Okay.
Like I said, it wouldn't fly under our system of law.
Yeah, my beloved English people, friends, just Jesus
what are
Christ.
You doing? Yeah. Yeah. Now, a few others, though, that had one. The picture we had of a tiny kid and a other kid walking with him, a slightly bigger kid walking with him in a mall. That was actually notorious child killer John Venables, who killed James Bulger in the early 90s in Great Britain. He was like 12 when he killed this kid who was a toddler. He was like 5 or 6. But John Venables has an anonymity order. And also Ian Huntley's partner, Maxine Carr, who killed 2 women. It's usually only used for released people.
Sure.
But McGreevy, in any press about him over there, could only be referred to as Prisoner M.
Wow.
So, yeah, he said that any coverage of him would endanger his life.
Well, but, I mean...
No. Fuck you, man.
Yeah.
With that.
You know, there's a legal argument about sex offender registries that goes along the lines of, you know, it's a continuing punishment for them beyond, you know, their sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That they're convicted, they serve their sentence, but after they're serving their time, paying their price, you know, paying their for their punishment, they continue to be punished beyond the scope of the sentence by having to register as sex offenders. And there's some validity to that. There's also very strong arguments on the other side of that. But that is so much more valid than what this guy had.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And now, luckily, his AO, his anonymity order, was challenged by various British media in 2013.
Yeah.
The court agreed and they overturned it. They threw it out. But this case doesn't end because he was ultimately released last year, July of 2019. So, yeah, he is walking the streets. David McGreevy.
So, after how much time?
1973 to 2019. So seven. I'm having difficulty doing math right now.
It's over 20 years.
What is it? Yeah. I mean, it's over the 20-year sentence, but the 20-year minimum sentence for a triple murder just is also doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah.
At all. You give somebody like that life in prison. But the other problem here is that because we don't know why he did it, he could still be a threat.
Yeah.
What's to say that won't happen again?
We'll find out.
Yeah. Unfortunately. But that is more or less the saga of a quote-unquote normal man.
Well,
went wrong.
You'd think they would have given him some psych evals in prison before turning him loose. I mean, you'd hope.
Well, I don't know. I mean, after how they were holding on to that early one from the military, I don't know.
So let me ask you this. Let's say it's coming up on his, at any point while this guy's in prison, and you do a psych eval, and it, what would freak you out the most? That there was nothing wrong with him, or that there was something wrong with him?
What would freak me out the most is that there's nothing wrong with him.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That he had no moral qualms about slaughtering three children the way that he did.
Yeah.
So.
And yeah, it's you just it. This is so out of left field, right?
Yeah. Oh, it really is.
I mean,
it's so novel.
This case. You know, the typical thing, oh, he was just a good, quiet guy, you know, he never caused any trouble, they say, of serial killers. But in this case, he really didn't cause much trouble. I mean, really minor shit.
Yeah. I mean, there's really no evidence that he did much of anything up until that.
Yeah.
So, it's a conundrum.
And he is too drunk to be, you know, good at being covering his tracks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that that whole scene was highly disorganized. But then it showed some traits of being organized, too. Like when he thought, you know, I have to chop the bodies up. So let's go get the pickaxe. Which, to be clear for people who maybe don't get that distinction between organized and disorganized, basically what it refers to is organized is any action that would be rational if you were committing that crime.
Right. Like, if you were fully in possession of your faculties and you decided to do it and you decided to cover it up and all those things.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, it shows it's really mixed, but yeah, I think it shows definitely more disorganized
right.
on that scale. It's just so bizarre.
You kind of wish there was something else going on, you know, like a hallucinogenic drugs or some shit.
Yeah, like his buddy putting something in his beer.
Right.
Or what have you. But
there's nothing to indicate that.
Nope. Nothing at all. And besides, like I said, I think you can make a good case for some of those mental illnesses that we were talking about. After looking through the DSM last night was when I thought about that. He hits about, as far as I could tell, 5 of the 7 clinically relevant things that have to be there for it, for borderline.
Wow.
Which I was just looking for that page again. Damn it, I lost my bookmark. Personality disorders, neurodevelopmental disorders, damn it. I think it's page 650-something. Yes, 645. So we'll take a quick look at those. Because it is interesting when you look at it. It is in the cluster A. With schizoid, paranoid, and schizotypal, I think. Or no, I'm sorry, cluster B. Personality disorders with APD. Antisocial personality disorder. So here's your diagnostic criteria for it.
Okay.
A pervasive pattern of instability of interpersonal relationships, self-image and affects, and marked impulsivity. Beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by five or more of the following. One, frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. Note, do not include suicidal or self-mutilating behavior. Two, a pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships characterized by alternating between extremes of idealization and devaluation. Three, identity disturbance, markedly and persistently unstable self-image or sense of self. Four, impulsivity in at least two areas that are potentially self-damaging.
At least.
Spending, spending, sex, substance abuse, reckless driving, binge eating, etc. Note, do not include suicidal or self-mutilating behavior because that's covered in number five. So I'll skip ahead to six. Affective instability due to a marked reactivity of mood. For example, intense episodic dysphoria, irritability, or anxiety, usually lasting a few hours and only rarely more than a few days. Seven, chronic feelings of emptiness. Eight, inappropriate intense anger or difficulty controlling anger.
Shut up!
And the last one, transient, stress-related paranoid ideation or severe dissociative symptoms.
Yeah.
So, I think you could make the case for at least five of those being present with what we know.
Yeah, and how many does it take? Simple majority?
Five. Yeah, five or more of them to get the diagnosis, according to the DSM-5.
But because he pled guilty, none of this came out.
No.
None of this was made public, whether, you know, he had an eval or not or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and none of it. And like the graphic says on the screen now, dissociation was associated with increased violence in populations like military veterans, which he's one, and quite a few others.
Well, that's not really surprising, though, is it? Dissociation with military and violence with military? Shock!
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, that's just the weirdest. I think it's one of the weirder ones we've looked at, precisely because just how normal he was.
Which is, you know, yeah, you can't. I'm sure there was a lot of blame going around with the parents back and forth, but you know, you can't. There's no blame to be had. You can't. Nobody saw this coming. There was nothing to see until it happened.
Yeah. Absolutely. There were no signs.
Yeah. There were no missed signs because there were no signs at all.
Right. Precisely. But yeah, this is a pretty good setup for what we're going to be doing next week, too.
And how
Which,
is
like
that?
Which, like we said at the top of this.
What is the tie-in with Killdozer?
The tie-in there, in my opinion, is another guy who was driven to do unreasonable things.
Mm.
Although
different causes, different effects.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think there was maybe a little bit more of a case for Killdozer.
Mm.
But it's another normal guy, you know?
Yeah.
Who literally was driven to building his own tank and raising a little hell with it. to put it mildly.
Oh, he's God, did he? And
yeah,
well, we'll get into this next week. The beauty of it is he really targeted the people who had wronged him, and not
yeah.
much of anybody else.
Yep, he did. I mean, of course, there's no excuse for killing children, but
no.
You know, there's definitely a, I mean, that's what we always search for, I think, on this show, is explanation.
And there isn't always one. And that's the kind of the scary thing about people. You don't always get to figure it out.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And you're right, Patty. It does make it extremely sad when there isn't one. Our brains crave meaning.
Absolutely. And we will invent meaning if we can't find any.
Yep. Precisely, we will.
So, but there's no meaning in this one. There is nothing.
None. Pure unadulterated nihilism, pure unadulterated acting out.
Yep.
So.
Yay.
Yep.
Okay. Well, that yep. about wraps it up for the Monster of Worcester or something, however you say it.
The Monster of Worcestershire sauce.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.